DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I am delighted to be joined once again by Vivian Doudreau, who is an editor for Ignatius Press. Over the last 30 years, she's written news articles, book reviews, and columns for various Catholic media, including the National Catholic Register and the Catholic San Francisco. She's been interviewed on radio and television programs, both Catholic and secular, on a variety of literary and religious topics. With Vivian Doudreau, we're going inside the pages of Edmund Campion, A Life, written by English author Evelyn Waugh, published by Ignatius Press. Vivian, thank you so much for returning.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I had a great time on your show last time, so thank you.
Well, let's talk about Edmund Campion, A Life. And this is the biography that was written by Evelyn Waugh, the author of Brideshead Revisited. And Edmund Campion, of course, was a Jesuit.
That's right, one of the early Jesuits who was sent back to England to minister to the persecuted Catholics there under the reign of Elizabeth I. The Jesuits were in a lot of countries in Europe during the Counter-Reformation, trying to win back the lost, basically, through teaching in universities, and Campion did that too. He taught in Eastern Europe. He didn't start out as a Jesuit, by the way. He went to Douay first, which was the English seminary on the continent where Catholics wanting to enter religious orders could flee England and go and get a real Catholic formation and become a Catholic priest. And many of these were sent back to England secretly to work underground. But Campion at some point decided to make this other step of becoming a Jesuit. It was while he was working in Prague that this plan of sending Jesuits in particular to England got underway. As a result, you know, with the victor gets to tell the story, right? In a way, mm-hmm. Protestantism did triumph in England and was the state religion, and still is the state religion even to this day, even though Catholics, I think Catholics now outnumber Anglicans in England now.
And are more fervent in their church attendance.
Yes, yes, that's right. And so he became a Jesuit, and, you know, St. Ignatius Loyola was a very interesting and intense kind of guy. You know, I mean, he was at first a soldier. He was obviously baptized a Catholic in a homogeneously Catholic society, but he had a conversion experience when he was recovering from a war wound. He got hit by a cannonball and was convalescing, and after he got tired of reading all the chivalry tales, he turned to reading the lives of the saints. Shows you how important biographies of saints really can be. Mm-hmm. And he has this conversion experience where he wants to be a soldier for Christ, sees in the saint a greater courage and glory than anything that could be won as just a soldier. So Ignatius, when he sets up his order, he didn't call the Jesuits, it was the Society of Jesus, and Jesuit was actually sort of an epithet, you know, that an mm-hmm. insult. But it stuck, and, you know, because of that military background, I mean, he went for guys who were like real guys, you know? I mean, guys mm-hmm. who were going to tough it out and go into tough situations and be disciplined and obedient. In fact, the chief virtue that was inculcated was obedience Same. To superiors, because the chief failing for most of us is pride. And then they had this special vow of obedience to the Pope. So that's why they kind of got nicknamed Popes, Marines, and Popes, whatever. But for all of that toughness and discipline and everything, you read Campion's life, you see at the core of it all is this tremendous love. Mm-hmm. Love for God and love for souls who are being lost, and such great love that he's willing to not fight with violence, but the opposite, even when, you know, give himself up to his captors when the time comes, and out of love even for his captors. He was actually doing penance while he was in prison.
Mm-hmm.
As if it weren't already bad enough, he's being put on the rack and he's being, what, do penance? Mm-hmm. Aren't you suffering enough? You know, if this isn't love, I don't know what is. It's the opposite of conquering by violence, you know?
I mean, he really did go back into that land, essentially with a death warrant on his head.
Yes, and they knew that. They knew that the likelihood of them being caught, spies knew that he was coming before he even got there.
Oh, the spies in England during that period. Oh, my goodness. I mean, it really literally could be your next door neighbor or your best friend.
Right. You had no idea who in fact, like Christ himself, he's betrayed by someone who pretended to be a loyal Catholic, and I think at one time even was a Catholic. I mean, you could predict who even someone who was friendly to you at one time may betray you in the next moment. So it was very precarious.
This is during the time, of course, of the reign of Queen Elizabeth of England, who I just think we need to set the record straight. She was no Kate Blanchett, who would ride the horse with the long flowing hair behind her and seemed like such a glamorous figure. She was responsible for the death, the gruesome death, of way too many Catholic martyrs during that period.
That's right. The Hollywood version of Queen Elizabeth leaves a lot to be desired in terms of its, yes, making her into a glamorous figure and so forth, which is interesting that Campion begins with the deathbed of Queen Elizabeth and what a revolting, repugnant figure she is in the end. And yet, her situation was not easy either, let's remember. I mean, she's the illegitimate daughter of Henry VIII. She can only hold on to her crown by continuing the Protestant revolt. Because she continues the Protestant revolt for very mercenary reasons, really. I mean, what she believes is kind of immaterial. This is all about power. And then she gets excommunicated by the Pope. As soon as she's excommunicated by the Pope, what that meant was her subjects no longer were to be obedient to her. Mm-hmm. So now she's constantly worried about revolt, violent overthrow, and there were attempts, you know, different rebellions and so forth. And so it became treasonous to be a Catholic. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't even a matter of what she believes. It's simply you either follow the state religion or you're a traitor to the crown. And the punishment for that is execution. And of course, this was happening. All of Europe now is racked with religious conflict. And, you know, Protestants and Catholics are rooting out those who don't adhere to the state religion. And so we kind of have to understand this was the times that the church was going through all over Europe. With Catholics and Protestants, once it declares itself as one religion or the other, you either go along with the guy in charge or you're toast. Right. Or you leave. You know, those are your choices. Difficult time.
Again, I think we need to really understand that history is that it wasn't about doctrinal issues or dogmatic pieces of the Catholic faith that people were trying to, quote unquote, reform in England. This was all about political power.
It was, because King Henry VIII, who broke with the church, you know, prior to that, he'd been declared defender of the faith because he had written a treatise in defense of the sacraments of the church. He thought Luther was a heretic. Mm-hmm. So King Henry VIII was given this title, Defender of the Church, and so he was not a heretic, but when he got thwarted by the Pope, you know, when he wanted to put away his wife and marry his mistress in this obsession for an heir, a male heir, and part of it, and also I think he was just, you know, a pervert. I think he ended up with syphilis or something. I mean, this combination of vice, the need to control, power, you know, all this stuff together in a man with that kind of uses of force at his disposal can become just a monstrous thing. So when he splits with the church and makes himself head of the Church of England, you know, doctrinally and the mass and so forth, he foolishly believed that all that was going to stay the same. Mm-hmm. But once you kind of decapitate the church like that and remove its head in the Pope, as much as the popes left a lot to be desired in the period leading up to the Reformation, let's face it, there were a lot of, let's just say, bad examples. Mm-hmm. So a lot of corruption and so on. So once you eliminate the unifying leader of the Pope, then it does become a doctrinal up for grabs. And of course, England, what rushed into England were all of these strains of Protestantism. And Elizabeth, to her credit, if you want to give her any, she did try to forge out what she called a middle way she was no friend of the Protestant fanatics either. Mm-hmm. And Puritans and other forms of Protestant offshoots and so forth were also persecuted. She tried to forge this middle way where the church would still have a liturgy and the church would still have... She personally liked the pomp and the smells and the bells and everything of high church ritual, which, you know, you wonder how some of these people did survive, like William Byrd, the English Renaissance composer, who's composing liturgies and sacred music for Elizabeth's private use, as well as for the ambassadors from Spain. What, he got a pass because she likes pretty things? I guess so.
Mm-hmm. She liked the music.
You know, so, you know, there was all of these weird contradictions to the thing. Now, what happened, though, is that when Henry made himself head of the church and then started seizing the monasteries for the wealth, mm-hmm. boy, this comes in handy. Mark these people out as your enemies and you get their stuff, you know, mm-hmm. so... He's destroying the monastery, seizing the wealth, and he's giving wealth to these cronies of his, too. So now you're creating a whole class of people who are benefiting from and being enriched by the Reformation. So mm-hmm. now you've got power, you've got wealth. So now doctrine is going to be used as a weapon to use against people to have power and wealth.
Yeah, I don't think you can understate either. The fact that that breaking with Rome because of the denial of the annulment, that you have to replace then the bishops, which are appointed by Rome. If you're going to have a church that worships, has a liturgy, you'll need a priesthood, but the priests are appointed by the bishops who are appointed by the Pope.
Right.
So you have to have the bishops. And they have to serve someone. They have to be answerable to someone. So that's how they become answerable. Well, we can't have the Pope. We're going to make them answerable to the king or queen, depending on the age.
Right. So now there's this question of, I guess the only bishop who withstood Henry VIII was John Fisher. Mm-hmm. And he, too, was martyred.
Yeah.
And we know the martyrdom of St. Thomas More, who was Henry VIII's chancellor, who tried very hard to just stay out of the way of the king. I mean, he did not go out of his way to tell the king he was wrong. But here's the interesting thing, and this is where doctrine does come into it sooner or later. Mm-hmm. It's going to come down to the truth sooner or later, and here's why. Because once a person sets his will on an objective, and it's wrong, and in conscience he probably knows it's wrong, he absolutely has to get everybody on the same page with him, and he will violate that inner sanctuary of the conscience. He will, because he just can't stand the idea that there's anyone out there who takes issue with what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And so Henry VIII actually kept pushing More to validate him in his decisions, and More finally had to say, no, I can't.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot tell you that, as much as you want me to tell you that what you're doing is right, can't do it. And when people are set on an evil course like that, they just can't live with that.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see that over and over and over again and get played out in society in numerous ways. I mean, the most recent issue right now all in our faces as Catholics is this decision by the Obama administration to make Catholic institutions pay for abortion-inducing drugs, other contraceptives, sterilization, and so forth. You know, it's not enough that they want to go do it. They have to make the very people who oppose it pay for it. What is that?
That's right. I think the struggle of every age is that when you read books like this, this is the value of reading a biography like Edmund Campion, A Life by Evelyn Waugh, is that when you see what happens there and how virtue is exhibited, then when we may never face the type of situations exactly that Edmund Campion found himself in, but it allows us to exercise the virtue so that when we come against something like that, we know what that emotion is, we know what that looks like, and we're able to exhibit the virtue that's required.
The example of someone willing to die for what he knows is the truth is such a powerful example. And in fact, while he was being executed at Tyburn, and it was very grisly, you know, first they hung them by a rope until they were just on the point of death, but not dead yet, and then they took them down, disemboweled them while they're still alive, and then cut them into four pieces and cut off their head and all this kind of, it was really a gruesome thing.
Yeah, barbaric.
Some fellow who happened to be standing while Campion was being executed, and a spot of his blood fell on his coat. And in that instant, he was transformed by this experience and determined to follow Campion's example.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, giving up home, wealth, position, becoming a hunted priest like Campion, you know, I mean, which is why the saying, age-old saying, that the blood of the martyrs is the seeds of the faith. A heroic example for truth has the power to convict and convert other people. Now, during this period of the Reformation in England and on the continent as well, you know, there were also Protestant martyrs. They, too, by their dying for their convictions, won more adherents. And so this is why the Church, in her wisdom, in modern times, has abandoned any attempt whatsoever to coerce the faith. It only makes martyrs out of her opponents.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Church is stuck with this looking weak in the face of the opposition. You see, it's
mm-hmm.
it's very hard to know what the right thing to do is, you know. So then you have, you know, all kinds of heresy and blasphemy and defamation of the Church going on, you know, in all directions, and you just meekly take it because why? Because you don't want to compel and coerce people to believe like you do. But it puts the Church in a position of weakness. But we have to have the confidence and faith that, but that's the position our Lord himself put himself in.
Mm-hmm. You look at an example like Edmund Campion, who came back into the country, and in his form of rallying the faithful was to feed them the Eucharist, to give them the Word of God, to stand in solidarity with them. And, you know, the fact that he came back, even under that type of thing, it reminds me of others who would follow that same type of example. I'm thinking of Blessed Miguel Pro in Mexico in the 1920s. So many of us in North America, so many as I should say in the United States, have little appreciation of the fact that there are Catholic martyrs that were killed and lifted up even of the last 100 years, and yet we don't know them. We don't know their stories.
Anything about them. It's not taught in our history classes.
It's tragic.
Persecution of the Church after the communist-inspired constitution was adopted in Mexico in 1917, and this horrible persecution of the Church began. And most people of my acquaintance who just got the typical history education at school or whatever, I went to public schools, we never even heard anything about this.
Right.
Well, one of the sad reasons for that is because the present foreign policy of the United States government was on the side of the government becoming secularized and anti-clerical. For all of our talk about religious freedom, it doesn't apply to the religious freedom of Catholics for some strange reason.
That's right. How about that?
Yeah. So, you know, and again, there's echoes of a debate that's raging right now in our society about religious freedom and what are the limits that we put on government because we value that freedom. And so, obviously, it's an ongoing debate. And it was a debate that was going on in England at the time that Campion was martyred. Of course, the concept of religious freedom wasn't even a concept until after the Reformation and then the religious wars, you know, 30 Years' Wars. And I mean, finally, Europe just got exhausted
mm-hmm.
of all of this fighting over religion. At about the same time as the Enlightenment so-called thinkers who began to value secular states, non-confessional states. We're not going to have Catholic states and Protestant states. We're going to have secular states. But even how that got worked out to still tolerate the Church, because the Church was against secular states. It condemned it as a modern, liberal, modern heresy that you could have. It was truly based on the belief that if you tolerate error, you put people's souls in harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a while to work out, even among Catholic thinkers, how do you respect religious freedom And how do you keep society glued together at the same time?
Well, it is interesting, isn't it, Vivian, that when you look back into the 1800s, that when you had the experience of Pius IX, if I'm not mistaken, and the relinquishing of the Papal States in Italy, to the point where now what we understand, the Vatican, the Holy See, you are primarily not in charge of governing large lands, but you're freed up the Holy Father in a very real way.
Maybe it really did.
You would have Pope Leo XIII then, and that just a series of unbelievably fantastic, strong, theologically sound men who were needed for the time in the world when it desperately needed that type of leadership, all the way up to the present day.
I mean, exactly. In fact, you could almost argue that, you know, God in his providence allowed the church, that the hierarchy of the church, to be freed from the constraints of having temporal authority. It gave them back their spiritual authority and their moral authority in a way that had been compromised prior to that because of their being involved. But in fact, when the church got released of this burden, if you will, she found again her moral authority, and it had real credibility now. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't look like, oh, you're just saying that because, you know, you've gone over to the French, or you've gone, oh, you're taking sides with the Spanish, or you're taking, you see, it was freed of that. And so you're absolutely right. And just in time for the rising ideologies of the 20th century, mm-hmm. fascism, Nazism, communism, you know, the church has been able to speak with a consistent voice on the meaning and purpose and dignity of the human person, on the rights of the individual, and so on and so forth. It found that voice really just in time.
You know, for Edmund Campion in particular, and along those Jesuits who went out into other lands to help bring the message of the gospel, but also all of the English martyrs in particular, because they were not all priests. Or those in religious orders.
Oh, no, there were lay people, in fact, women as mm-hmm. well. St. Margaret Clitheroe, you know, who refused to go to the Anglican services. One way they smoked out the Catholics, so to speak, you know, was to pass laws requiring attendance at Anglican services. So if you didn't show up, you see, you were suspect. And Margaret Clitheroe refused to go. She was crushed alive between two millstones. This mother of six or seven children, this, you know, I mean, so interestingly enough, though, I think a couple of her sons became priests, and there's that blood of the martyrs again, fueling the faith of those that come next. But lay people suffered terribly. Many of them lost first all their property, then their liberty, and then finally their lives. It was a brutal, brutal persecution of anyone not towing the line of the state church. It destroyed families, wiped them out entirely.
It's something to ponder when you think that Evelyn Waugh would bring this book forward to be published for the first time in 1945, immediately following a scourging that England endured during the entire Second World War. Not to mention what happened during the First World War, but this time the war came to them. Across the sea.
And he fought in the war, too. He served in the war in several different capacities and saw action in several different countries, in fact. So I think the question of what is courage and what is cowardice was something that he experienced firsthand. Mm-hmm. So this then inspiration to write about a great hero who could face and endure such brutality with such courage would really capture your imagination, having gone through experiences like that.
Yeah, I found it just a compelling read, very poignant, but also it just beautifully done. I mean, we've mentioned that before in our previous discussions, Vivian. I mean, this really, as far as biography goes, this is a word art, if there's
right.
such
well,
a phrase. But it's just, it's so incredibly sacred.
Well, Waugh is considered one of the great prose stylists of the 20th century. I mean, this is literary acclaim that he has received. It has nothing to do with his faith. So when you take a talent like that, a literary talent like that, and put it in the service, the truths of the faith and the heroes of the faith, I mean, you've got a pretty potent combination there.
Mm. I love it. Edmund Campion, A Life. Vivian, this is just so much fun talking to you about these great works. Any final thoughts on this particular piece?
I would encourage people to find out about the true history of the Reformation in England, because we are living in an English-speaking society. We've learned this history usually through English-speaking sources that favor the triumph of Protestantism in England, and look rosily on the reign of Queen Elizabeth and others. And then on top of it, you've got the Hollywood version, where the Jesuits are turned into fiendish, cruel, perverse sorts of dark, sinister characters. It's like, what the heck? Where did that come from, you know?
Right.
So in a way, it behooves American Catholics to learn a little bit about this period of history. It'll really open their eyes, because they'll go, gosh, never heard that side of the story before. Mm-hmm. And Campion is a great way to do it, because he is just such an admirable man that he's certainly the poster boy for the English who paid for the faith with their lives in that period. So, I recommend delving into it for that reason, if for no other.
He'll become a saint you'll find yourself just kind of falling in love with, knowing that in this great communion of saints, he's someone we can pray with as well. To get to know him, it is a gift in itself, I really think.
And, we're still in the Counter-Reformation, if you stop to think about it. I mean, we still are, Catholics in the United States of America are a minority. We sometimes don't remember that because
these days I think it's becoming a little bit more obvious.
Yeah, but. And then on top of it, those who really take to heart the truths of the faith and try to live them as best they can, that's a shrinking minority. The majority of Catholics being those who might have been baptized and even educated as such, but no longer practice the faith. So I think in these times can really take heart from knowing that Catholics in the past, and not even that long ago, have suffered far worse than this, and also that the church survived. The amazing story is, in a way, is that the church survived in England, and now, as we remarked earlier, there are more practicing Catholics than practicing Anglicans in mm-hmm. England. So you have to have a long-term perspective. It really helps you get through short-term crises when you have a long-term perspective, and I would even say if you have an eternal perspective, mm-hmm. and you don't lose sight of where your ultimate home is. It's not here. So
that's right.
To keep the faith in good times and bad, we need the example and intercession of the saints.
Amen. Vivian Doudreau, thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
With Vivian Doudreau, we've gone inside the pages of Edmund Campion, A Life. Written by Evelyn Wall, published by Ignatius Press. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Ignatius.com, the website for its publisher, Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to DiscerningHearts.com. This has been a DiscerningHearts.com production. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.